This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm here with James LaFond. He is a writer, blogger, and self-defense expert based out of Baltimore. James, it's great talking to you.
Thanks for having me on, Robert. I'm very excited.
And I'm also joined here with Paul Bingham.
Good to be on here, Robert.
Nice to meet you, Paul.
Likewise, Mr. James.
James, in your writings, on your blog, and in your books, you mostly focus on your experiences living in Baltimore. To start things off, how many books have you published, and have most of them been about the topic of life in Baltimore?
I just looked at my Amazon listing. It's got 194 titles listed, but 70 of them are the book being counted twice because it's on Kindle. So I'm kind of a goon when it comes to uploading my own stuff on this POD platform. The last time when my editor checked, she said that I've had somewhere between 130 and 140 books completed. I know I've done at least 20 Harm City books, which is the Baltimore violence stuff. And some of that branches off into something that's more combat-oriented. And some of it also branches off, like Taboo You really branched off into masculinity out of the urban violence experience. But as far as the pure urban blight survival books, I think it's 23 or 24.
And a lot of them are based on interviews you've conducted throughout life in Baltimore.
Yes. If you're unfortunate to know me in person, then you know I will forever be inquiring as to your adventures, going to the grocery store, or whatever might have happened in your daily life. I actually have a number of people who just call me. I spent most of my life working in the supermarket industry, and I have people in different companies that will just call me and give me the news for the violence and the shoplifting and the parking lot mayhem for that particular location. Kind of lucked out with that, with the riots in Baltimore. I had some friends that worked at the store, which was actually the target of the initial purge that was going to be conducted by the Frederick Douglass High School students. And the people in the store found out because one of the lady's daughters, she was snooping on her daughter's Facebook feed, and she saw that they were going to come loot the store, and they had an on duty.
You were working at?
This is a store that I never worked at, but a lot of people that I've worked with have been assigned to the store because it's a high volume, high crime store, and they have a contract with Baltimore City Police Department that they will pay overtime rate for a uniformed BPD officer to be on duty. They got that through a congressman. The congressman actually got investigated over this deal. He was really doing a good deed for the neighborhood. He was making sure that his constituents could actually have a supermarket to go to. So he didn't end up getting in any trouble over it. But so that's how I found out. That supermarket ends up becoming the Baltimore Police and National Guard rally point during the riots, and I had three co-workers that were working there. One of the guys got stuck there for like 30 hours.
How long have you lived in Baltimore, basically your entire life?
I was born in Baltimore City in 1963. In 1976, my father moved my mother and my brother and sister and I to Washington, Pennsylvania, which is between Wheeling, West Virginia and Pittsburgh. And I stayed there until I was 18. I committed a violent felony. I got off. But there was danger of me being sued, which is really why I got off, because they wanted to sue me. So my father recommended that I move back to Baltimore. Him and my mother had split up. So I moved in with my mother for a few months. Then when I got a job, that was in 81, I started renting a room with some supermarket people. We rented a 1-4 flat over top of a bar in Northeast Baltimore, a quarter mile from where I sit right now. So I've been in Baltimore continuously since 81.
Would you say it was as dangerous back then, or you witnessed a major decline?
Oh, as far as danger goes, in 1981, I could go out and I could sleep for 3 days on a bench at a bus stop and probably nothing would happen to me. I might get rousted by a cop. When I go out at night now, in fact, I haven't for a while because I suffered a writing injury and I also stopped working my nighttime supermarket job. The last time I went to work, which was about a month ago, it was 3 weeks ago, there were only 5 people on foot in the 12 miles where I traversed, partially on foot, partially on bus, from Northeast Baltimore to Eastern Baltimore County. There was myself and there were 2 pairs of muggers out hunting people, and both pairs came after me because I was the only prey available. So the place has changed entirely. It's almost like some mad scientist decided that he was going to conduct a test. And I've been lucky enough as a writer to be here.
Why have you decided to stay in Baltimore? Have you thought about leaving?
Yes, I've most of my family has left Baltimore. They did a long time ago. I actually have left Baltimore City numerous times while still working in Baltimore City. I had to, in 1998, I had to put my house up for sale. That I was the last Caucasian to purchase a house in a neighborhood called Gardenville, which has about 5,000 homes in it. And then I got a nice pair of neighbors moved in, a paralegal and I think a physical therapist. They were really great people, middle class black folks. They didn't have any kids. And as soon as they moved in next door to me, all of my older white neighbors started to move. And at the same time, Baltimore City demoed 3 major housing projects. 2 of them, Murphy's Homes and Hollander Ridge, were served by 2 bus lines each. All 4 of these bus lines intersected my neighborhood. So when all the people from these high-crime projects were giving housing vouchers, they came into my neighborhood. So by 98, it was my wife had been barricaded in the house for 6 months. My sons were being robbed out of doors. My oldest son, we moved to Harford County to save his life. I was being attacked on an almost nightly basis. And I got a lot of print material out of this from my early violence books. But after one episode where my wife and I were threatened by 2 young men, one of whom claimed to have a firearm, she demanded that I get her and the family out of Baltimore City. So I had to leave the house vacant because we had it up for sale for 2 years and we couldn't sell it. And I moved them to a rental in eastern Baltimore County to a place called Dundalk, which is a lower working class, a lower middle class to working class, predominantly white neighborhood. It was the only place I could afford a rental. But I still worked in Baltimore City. Even when I took over managing a Baltimore City supermarket, I actually lived 4 miles away, right over the city line, which just by happenstance was the rental that I stumbled into when my wife kicked me out of the other county residence. But then when I quit the management job, and got a small part-time job outside of the city, making about, you know, 1/12 of the salary, I was in need of a very cheap rental, so I had to move back into the city. A good friend of mine, who's a fellow self-defense instructor, has a very large house, and I'm sitting in right now. It's an old orchard house from 1911, I think. And these things are, when you look at the houses on the street, a third or a quarter of them are mansions, and this is close to a mansion. Across the street is a real mansion, and he of course had plenty of room, so he rented me a room, and I've been here ever since. I will probably be moving away next month, because now that I quit my part-time job and I'm only living off of my writing, I'm going to be seeking a cheaper rental than this place. So I'll and my son has asked me to move into the county and not deeper into the city. He was pretty much horrified by the thought of me doing that. So I'm doing so. I'll probably be in a portion of Baltimore County that's currently being targeted for resettlement of criminal populations out of the worst parts of Baltimore City. Baltimore County just lost a $320 million lawsuit waged by the federal government against Baltimore County. And they now have to spend that amount of money, $320 million, resettling fatherless, low-income families from the highest crime areas of Baltimore City into Baltimore County. And that's the part of Baltimore County I'm moving into because the rental prices are down right now because everybody's selling. They're trying to get out.
Paul, do you want to ask a question?
Yes.
Yeah. if you're currently considering, living off the income from your writings, have you thought of putting up a Patreon or other artist-type funding?
Yes. I actually spent the weekend with my son, because I'm pretty much an idiot when it comes to doing anything online. I spent a weekend setting up a PayPal thing and a Patreon account. The Patreon thing's I decided to really devote it to my American history research, because it's set up that way. They want you to have a theme. So I thought about what one of my writing projects I was most passionate about, and I started the Patreon account for that. And I goonishly forgot to send my Patreon link to Robert in my little assembly of links, of self-promotional links. But it's out there. I do have a Patreon page, and I have 3 subscribers, and I'm thrilled at that. And I'm putting up as much stuff as I can on there. I've just read 2 books that I'm going to write the reviews and put them up on the Patreon page for the members.
Well, if it's possible, could you put that out on your Twitter page, and we will definitely try to share it for you.
Oh, thank you, sir. Yes, I will. I will have my Twitter page is actually run by my head, Lynn, and she for some reason took on the burden of trying to promote me. So I'll make sure that I ask her to do that. She'll do it. No, she's great.
You were saying earlier that you did get some publicity for your work when the riots were happening. Was that last summer or the summer before that?
It was the last week of April 2015. When they started, and I had a number of large boosts, and I should thank these people. Number one, I had readers from Paladin Press readers found me when fighters set up a website for me, and I started getting a trickle of people. But then a fellow named Bart Manet, who set up a Facebook page for me, shopped my book to Jack Donovan, a masculinity writer by the name of Jack Donovan, who plugged my book, and he reviewed it, and I've got about 1,000 readers from Jack. And then Ann Sterzinger did an article called Graphomaniac, in which she covered some of my work, and I got 1,500 readers immediately out of that, and I still have people that occasionally find her old article in Tacky Mag, and they contact me. And then when the riots hit, about 1,000 people that were looking for coverage of the Baltimore riots ended up following the riot as I wrote about it on a day-by-day basis. When I was actually writing about what we call the purge, which was just the hunt for, pedestrians, mostly pedestrians on foot, by groups of men who were fanning out. All the police from Baltimore City were all at one rally point, and all of the police from Baltimore County moved to the county seat, which straddles York Road, which goes to York, Pennsylvania, and that road is the way into the really deep affluent suburbs of central Baltimore County. They were all devoted to protecting that. So Baltimore City and most of Baltimore County was entirely unpoliced for 10 days. So I had a lot to write about there.
Did you have a strong opinion on the whole, like, Freddie Gray incident?
Unfortunately, this guy died during an arrest that a number of my friends have been arrested in similar circumstances. The cops always make sure they bang your head on the watch your head, boom, then they bang it on the roof of the car while they're putting you into the back of the car. When you run from the Baltimore City police, you're playing concrete football. And especially like the bicycle cops, two of the guys that ran him down were bicycle cops, and these are like really athletic dudes. And I know a number of guys. In fact, there's a guy named Schmitty that lives across the street from me. I've seen him beaten up numerous times by the Baltimore City Police Department, and all they were doing was arresting him on suspicion of going to a crack house down on Bayonne Avenue and buying a rack of crack. I mean, he's an employed dude. He's got his own home employment business. He's not violent, but he buys crack cocaine one rock at a time. And these cops will beat him up and shove him in a car because he's spent $10 on a rock and stuff. So it was really a very typical arrest. As I did follow the legal case, and the black judge, who is a very liberal man, was disgusted by the case that was brought against the police officers because the cops didn't really do anything malicious. As far as I know, none of the dozens of men who I know who have been arrested have ever been strapped into the back of a police van. It's just something that's never been done. They're usually in a hurry. They got a lot of stuff to do. They chuck you in, and you're usually an athletic young guy, and you're not too injured, so it's never been a big problem. I have a friend who both of his brothers were beat to death in the 1980s by Baltimore City police officers. Where are we beaten to death? The one of his brothers was beaten so bad he was unconscious, and then when he got to the corrections facility, those guys beat him again, and he died there. There weren't even legal cases over this, and these were white dudes, by the way, and they were knuckleheads. They fought the cops. That's what you get when you fight the cops. But there wasn't anything unusual about this this incident with Freddie Gray, and his family even thought so. What was unusual was that the DOJ, basically the Department of Justice, basically announced that they were going after the Baltimore City Police Department and sending agents in to investigate them. And three gangs, one of them was Crip 52, I think, and the other one was the big gang in Baltimore, the Black Gorilla Family, BGF. They announced that they were going to start killing cops. And this was done to make sure that the cops would pack up into groups and they would lose their intelligence, to their ability to gather intelligence on the crime scene. This was then the children from Frederick Douglass High School were told by members of these gangs that if they conducted a purge of Mendelman, and they used this terrible Hollywood movie as an example, then there would be a free tryout to get into the gangs, and they wouldn't have to come up working a corner and maybe getting popped, while they're slinging drugs on a corner, and they'd get a quick track into the gang. Now, the reason why this purge was launched was to take all the police that had already been been hunkered down trying to defend themselves and not get in any trouble with the DOJ at the same time, and then make them defend a certain location. And every pharmacy in Baltimore City was simultaneously hit by professional break-in crews at 1 o'clock in the morning on the first night after the big riots. This was the Tuesday night after the riots lit up on Monday. And this was the goal, was to get their hands on all the opiates and fentanyl in the pharmacies. I have friends who operated liquor stores who lost their businesses over this. I have one young man who I coached who was a boxer, who was a sales rep at a cell phone store. Every cell phone store owned by that company was wiped out. He immediately was promoted to head of security for the cell phone chain, and they bought him a gun, they got him the certification, and he's now got a concealed carry permit, and he's now the head of security for this phone chain. So this was like a very targeted thing. The after the riots stopped, the different chain drug stores, they caged everything on the inside. They've got like three levels of armor, and they removed most of their sales inventory from the sales floor, and they just hired security people and cut down on customer service staff. So there's also 71 small businesses that are currently suing Baltimore City for openly condoning the looting. The mayor actually said that they let these people destroy what they wanted to destroy, and they believe that they, as private business owners, and most of these people are racial minorities, real racial minorities like Koreans and Indians and Pakistanis, they believe that they were targeted by Baltimore City officials and were not protected, so that Baltimore City could then bring in more chain operations, national outfits, which has happened. National outfits have been opening up in some of these areas where small business owners were burned out.
Paul, do you want to ask a question?
Yeah, James. During this time, did you personally witness many acts of violence, you know, in the streets or so on, or were you, you know, able to avoid some of that?
I had two attempts against myself during this period. I have a friend who's an orthopedic surgeon who works in an emergency room. I got a lot of my information about attacks on people that he treated, and these were all lone white males, predominantly middle-aged, who were using buses for transportation, just like me, in the same area of Eastern Baltimore County. And I was one of the men who was attacked and who was non-injured because I was armed. I actually armed myself with a knife. I threw it in the river before I went to work, because we sometimes had police officers come into work for different things, and I didn't want to be caught with a knife that was beyond the legal length for Baltimore County. We had young black men came into the store where I worked and tried to pick a fight with me. They started destroying the dairy case that I was working on, looking me in the eye, kicking the case, and trying to get me to say something to them, and I did not. The other men on the night crew actually armed themselves with pallet slats. We were the only business open. The 7-Eleven had to close because it's just one guy couldn't defend the location. He locked himself in. But we were the only business open in all of Middle River after hours, and we had people who were being attacked coming to us for protection. So Tony had the whole night crew up front with pallet slats as weapons, and we're just defending the place. And, you know, the locals knew that. They're not going to come in and tussle with 6 or 7, you know, guys that work with their hands and are wielding 2x4s. So we became a place where people came for protection, and we actually had two black men who were middle-aged men who picked up young white women who were actually running for their lives from gangs of young black men, and they brought them to the store for protection. The police would not come and talk to these ladies. We couldn't get police to come to the store for over a week, so we were basically it. You basically had a supermarket crew served as a stationary police station for a Baltimore County precinct during that period.
Yes, sir. You would make the case that the police make it more difficult to defend yourself rather than doing their job to protect the public.
Well, see, I believe their job is to dissuade people from defending themselves, because that's all I've seen in my life. Now, I do know, I have, for 4 years, I ran a supermarket in a very high crime area, and most of the police officers that I interacted, I can tell they had orders that defending my business was a priority, and they came and they helped. I had a couple of police officers threaten my life while I had that job, but that's just because they wanted to break the law and I wouldn't let them. And three of them threatened my co-manager's life, again, because they wanted to break the law, and he wouldn't let them. He was the real citizen police officer. But as far as helping us against the criminal class, the cops were very good to go in this when you represented a business that had a good size footprint. But as an individual, I would have men, and mostly black men, that would be attacked by other black men on the way to work, and they would also be attacked by police officers. I would lose a clerk 1 week to the cops, and I'd lose a clerk another week to the muggers. I had one guy who actually used to work as security detail for Wayne Newton in Las Vegas. He was a professional kickboxer in the 70s, and he had developed a heart condition in his old age, and he had cancer, and I gave him a job. And on two different occasions, he was attacked by small mobs of armed black men, young black men, children actually, and had to defend himself. And on the one occasion where he successfully defended himself against a 20-year-old athletic light heavyweight man, he was then arrested by the police. When he came to me, he still had the bruises, because he bruised real easy because of his chemotherapy. He still had the bruises from the handcuffs, and of course his hands were completely bruised from beating up this young buck that he was slugging it out with. So I subscribe to the anarcho-tyranny model that the police are here to facilitate the terrorization of the general population, but to protect the businesses when possible from the criminal element. That's just what I've seen. It's my theory, and you know, I've written a number of books as proof of it, but you know, it's not going to gain wide currency.
Paul, do you ask a question?
Yeah. Do you anticipate in the near future, James, that there will be more riots in Baltimore, or what do you see in the near future will be the outcome of the situation?
It's a fascinating question, and I can tell you this. The day after the riots ended, when I no longer had to take a curfew pass with me back and forth to work, everybody in Baltimore said it's going to happen again, and it's not going to be long. And I said it too, and I think we were all wrong. We didn't realize that this was a paradigm shift. We didn't realize that. We thought that it was going to mean, because the riots were so successful, we thought that it was going to mean more frequent riots because they were so successful. But the riots were so successful that what they did is they got pared down into a dozen small riots a day. When you're a store manager in a supermarket, when you unlock that door at 6 o'clock in the morning, you've got three young men standing there with canvas sacks ready to come in and loot. They have shopping lists that have been given to them by people who fence their goods. And you've got you maybe got a security guy. If you're lucky, you got a cop. So if you got the three-man team, which costs you $150,000 a year, and that's more money than most supermarkets make in profit a year, then yeah, you could stop that. But if you're Mark down the street and it's just you, and you got a couple of female cashiers there, then you got to stop selling Tide. So because they're just going to take it all off your shelf and you can't stop them. So I don't think we're going to have more of these large riots. There were attempts, BLM. Black Lives Matter, which I actually think will eventually morph into a paramilitary organization in the future, they tried to incite two additional riots, and they didn't work. And a friend of mine was at one of the pending riots, and he was calling me and letting me know what's up. And it didn't work. The fact is, there's not a need for it, because if you want to go out and cause trouble, you can get together with 30 of your mates right out of school, and you can pick up bricks from the old lady's garden across the street, and you can go trash a business, you can go attack a group of people, and you're probably not even going to be interdicted by the police. I've seen this happen. I've had groups of young men who just got out of school come after me when I'm coming back from the supermarket. And I get through it because I've actually, it's basically been my living. Dealing with aggression for a living. And as soon as they find out you're going to rip their guts out with a knife, the pending attack becomes a giggle or a bunch of guys stepping back and when you walk by. I don't think there's going to be another big riot. And unless there's got to be something. By the way, one of the things that triggered this riot, this was a planned riot, was the way the food stamp cycle worked. We call it EBT cash and EBT food. EBT cash comes out the first. EBT food used to get between the 6th and the 16th. April was a long month, and this riot kicked off on the 27th, which means you had a lot of people who haven't had any money or any foodies, any food stamps, for 3 weeks or more. So later that year, the food stamp system was updated. This was the smartest thing that the federal government ever did. And you now have your foodies come out between the 3rd and the 27th. So you don't have a large group of people that hadn't had any income for a while. So if we see riots in Baltimore again like this, I think it's going to be because the EBT system goes down. Okay, if the EBT system is down for 3 days, you've got unrest. 5 days, you got a riot. If it goes down for a month, you've basically got Beirut 1980s on your hands. I would see that, and the gangs knew that, and that's why they timed. Freddie Gray died at a fortuitous time. They were able to really time this all. And chain the events together very well, so they get their hands on the fentanyl. And at the same time, all the cameras, the news cameras, are all on these kids that are basically earning a place in a gang down the road. They're now famous young adults in Baltimore City because they were out there, you know, fighting the man in the Great Uprising. And the white liberal establishment in Baltimore now calls it unrest and uprising, a justifiable uprising against white privilege and oppression. So, what do you say to that? I mean, in the meantime, I'm like this, I'm wearing a 30-year-old jacket, you know, I'm recovering from numerous work injuries, and I'm hobbling to work on a cane, and I've got, I've got guys hunting me on the street, you know, so...
The Black Lives Matter movement was making it out to be a racial issue, but from my understanding, aren't the majority of the Baltimore police black?
Yes, sir. They're predominantly black, and they're overrepresented whenever you have police brutality. They tend to be overrepresented in that. And there's also the situation that most of the people that were attacked during the riots were black. Most of the businesses that were looted were, these were black people lost their jobs. They lost a place to shop. There is one good story that I'll tell you about. There's a supermarket chain from Harford County that opened up a store that's right down the street from the one that was targeted for extermination, where the whole mall got wiped out, and the Target has since gone out of business. They have somebody like me who advised them on how to open up this store, and they hired local people. All their employees are black, and all those black employees, they made a human chain on the supermarket lot, and they told these thugs, this is our supermarket, this is where we work, you're not destroying our supermarket. Unarmed, middle-aged black people stopped the riot, okay, where hundreds of armed Baltimore City police officers were unable to stop the riot. And a lot of that had to do with the social mechanics of the situation, the fact that this supermarket owner knows how to operate under the social circumstances, and the police force has been pressured by the feds to conduct a drug war, which has really ill-prepared them for dealing with this type of unrest, and has actually made them an incendiary force in generating the unrest. Now, I know one man personally who knocked down 711 doors. This dude kicked in 711 doors of households in Baltimore, and half of these places were straight-up crack houses. But a number of these places was just a place where some family lived, and somebody that didn't like the mother of that family called the cops and said it was a crack house. So then mama ends up on the floor getting handcuffed, and her sons are getting roughed up by cops in body armor. And 5 years later, it's not hard to talk these guys into committing what would otherwise be senseless violence, because they believe that they're exacting a type of tribal revenge against, you know, an enemy force.
Are a lot of the thugs, either, you said in a previous interview, a lot of them are dating the government employees, including the police.
Absolutely. Dude, this is the oldest trick in the book, and actually they learned it from biker gangs, okay? It's no surprise to anybody in law enforcement. It was well depicted in the HBO miniseries The Wire. And yes, that is the case, but you also have... they don't have to be dating government employees. They could be dating a private employee. They could be dating the dispatcher for an armored car service. They could be dating the head cashier at a supermarket, where my friend was managing a supermarket, and when he got out on the parking lot, one day a week he had to take the cash. They couldn't afford to have an armored car every day of the week. For that seventh day, there's a big upcharge. You know, so he's a big, tough Polack, a guy I used to box with. He's like, okay, you know, once a week I tuck 20 grand under my arm and I go to the bank. And he goes out the door, and there's two black dudes waiting for him, and one of them's got a gun. The fat dude's got the gun, and he can't chase him. So the skinny guy's behind the wheel of this late model Buick, and he hits Mark in the ass with a front fender. As Mark's trying to throw the money up onto the roof of the building, the money goes up into the wheel well of this car, so they don't get it. And they take their ski masks off. They leave all the DNA there. They leave their cell phones there. Well, the police tell Mark that these guys on their cell phone got a phone call from the store's office phone right when he walked out the door. So the chick that was sitting next to him, that actually bundled up the money and put it in stacks of $10,000 for him to take away, immediately got on the phone with her boyfriend and said, my boss is walking out the side door with the money. Okay, so it's for every one of these government employees that's dating a gangbanger, there's some chick that's handling money someplace in a private business that's dating a gangbanger. So you got to think about that.
Paul, do you ask a question?
Yeah, shifting gears a little bit, James, to go to your fictional output, which is prodigious.
Oh, thank you.
You said, I think, in a different interview that you wanted to put out more books than Louis L'Amour or something like that.
But, yeah, well, he's a hell of a lot better boxer than me, so if I could write more books than him, I would at least have that.
Well, I...
yeah, I said that. Yeah,
I think a lot of his fights were kind of undocumented, whereas your record is... I think a little bit more, you know, out in the open, as it were. But
yeah, as far as I know, he was 58-8. Fighting what was regarded as not a tough professional circuit. I'm sure he had many more than the 21 amateur boxing matches that I had. And most of these amateur boxing matches that I had are actually illegal gypsy rules boxing matches, or really primitive MMA. Okay, 7 of them were bare knuckle fights, you know, against wrestlers and stuff like that. So Louis could have actually been a contender. He could have been a middleweight contender. I'm pretty certain of that. And he had a very robust physical frame. I was a mediocre amateur welterweight. So a whole different animal. So as a boxer, look up to the guy a whole lot. He actually helped train a couple of pro boxers too. And wrote some boxing fiction, and I've written some boxing fiction as well, and I love the boxing fiction of him and Robert E. Howard. I like reading that a lot.
It seems like your work is largely in the horror, science fiction, slash fantasy genres. Would you say that was primarily where your over lies, one might say?
I tell you, when I saw that Robert here wrote a fusion science fiction fantasy book, I was thrilled that I wasn't going to be getting interviewed by a guy that wrote, like, straight, hardcore, spent 3 years majoring in physics, sci-fi guy. So I'm glad that there's a fusion guy on the other end here. I have set out numerous times to write pure hard science fiction. I've set out to write pure fantasy. I've usually failed. I usually end up writing something that's a hybrid horror or science fantasy. And the only story that I think that I'm actually managed to write, that, most of my straight science fiction is more like in the vein of Philip K. Dick, that's more along the lines of looking at social impacts in future high-tech societies than it is hard science fiction, especially having a space exploration. And I guess a lot of the stuff that I've done is like Last Day on Earth stuff, like alien invasion stuff, which all becomes horror, you know, as soon as the intergalactic cuckoo hits the fan, it's pretty much a horror story. I think I've done like 4 novellas or novelettes that were like Last Day on Earth, different versions. So yeah, it's kind of a hybrid. The Jericho Bone was actually almost straight historical horror in which I injected a extraterrestrial horrific element. So my injection of additional horror into it was actually science fiction and not horror. There's no supernatural horror element to it. I suppose that an alien intelligence that was a failed colonizer of the Earth that was basically got damaged and was not able to seed the planet, but just able to keep himself alive by adopting terrestrial life forms, was kind of in the position of being an observer of the famine of Egypt in 1201, which is like the biggest historical horror story ever. And so that's probably the closest thing I did to doing something pure, and even that I threw I put a science fiction element in it. So so far I haven't succeeded in writing anything that that fits squarely into a subgenre of the speculative fiction spectrum.
Well, I think I really like the Jericho Bone. I'll say it like this. I think it really had me going.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. I mean, there's not many people who have read that. I've already sold any of them.
Well, I'm one of the few buyers, I guess. My eventual hope is to obtain all your works in one form or another. I'm not a really big Kindle reader, so I like to have the physical copy.
What e-books you'd like to have my own e-copies of? I could send you those. Hopefully, you keep getting some of my print books. But yeah, if you got something that you really want to see, and you don't have the money to get the print book, just contact me and say, "Hey, James, I'd like to read this. Could you send me a copy?" I've done that with readers. One fellow he asked how much it would cost to get a copy of my own PDF of 40,000 Years from Home, and that was a few months ago. I was like, "Dude, just write a review for me, because nobody's reviewed it," and he did, and I sold two copies. Yeah, so that was cool. I mean, anybody wants to contact me for that kind of arrangement for one of my titles, I'm more than glad to oblige. I'm honored that somebody would read it.
Well, I feel like you're flying way too far below the radar, and it's kind of hard to avoid that. You know, Robert was asking me about a target audience for his book, and I told him I really can't think of one. There's not a lot of people reading anymore. And on the other hand, I was on Twitter the other day, and I tweeted to the producer of the Hap and Leonard show. I don't know if you're familiar with the Hap and Leonard series.
No, sir, but I'll make a note of it.
I've always thought the guy who wrote it, I can't think of his name, was like a pale imitation of you, yet he's more well known as a writer. But anyway, I told him, I tweeted to the producer, I said, "You should have James LaFond do the script for this TV series, because I just think that would add a lot of vitality to it." I watched the first season, I guess the second season's out. Basically, it's about a black and Vietnam vet who's gay, and his partner, and they're detectives, and his partner is a white ex-hippie type, and it's got elements of horror, and
that's set up for a lot of fun. You can have a lot of fun writing episodes with two characters like that.
Yeah, I would think that would be something in your wheelhouse if you could get a job writing a script for something like that. But anyway, I did recommend you to the producer
for what
good that could do on Twitter, a random voice among millions.
Well, hopefully, this young man, Robert Stark, is going to end up in the future being a best-selling novelist, and somebody will interview him, and he'll drop my name, and then my grandchildren will get some royalties off of the sales that generated. Should I? That would be a best case scenario as far as I'm concerned. I'm really trying to produce a body of work that will produce some residuals for my inheritors. There's a woman who died not long ago. She was, I think, a niece of Robert E. Howard, a sweet lady, and his works ended up selling millions, even though much of his stuff was never bought during his lifetime, and he ended up being able to provide for people that were close to him down the line. And as a writer, that's my ambition. It's one reason I don't try to write popular stuff, because I when I'm doing historical research, I don't run across anything that's significant that was popular when it was written. You look at Moby Dick. I think it sold like 1,200 copies or something in the century that it was written. Even Bram Stoker had a hard time with his work when he first came out with it. And Mary Shelley as well. You're not talking about people that were popular, but it was the next generation. J.R.R. Tolkien, I don't think, made a living off of his writing. He was a university guy. I read a review of his work in the mid-1970s where the reviewer was saying, "Finally, the unharvested literary crop of the early 1950s is being harvested. People are starting to read J.R.R. Tolkien." So I don't let myself be bothered about not being able to make bank now, as far as a writer, as long as I can write. And I've scaled back my my living expenses. That I don't need to make a lot of money.
You're kind of an authority on Robert E. Howard's writings. I'm thinking of not everybody I think can appreciate or write appreciations of Howard. I think L. Sprang DeCamp, the science fiction writer, wrote a biography of him, but
yes.
I don't feel like he could quite understand Howard as maybe an individual like you could, since you had experience in boxing. You kind of understand Howard's perspective on life, growing up trying to become a man, living in a world run by finance, which he was very dismissive of, or he wasn't very happy with the world he lived in. That dissatisfaction, that sense of masculinity, I think a lot of so-called historians can't quite grasp that that feeling of what it was like to be Howard, and that's what I like when you write about him.
Oh, thank you, sir. DeCamp had something to say about that. It was very brief. It was in his book, Debunking Atlantis Mythology. And he invoked Howard, and he spoke about him himself also taking a hand in these tales sometimes. He considered Howard lightly. Psychologically, to somebody like DeCamp, who's mentally more on a plane with hard science fiction people like Heinlein, a guy like Howard without a military background, and who there's Baltimore's finest again, they've been going by a lot today. Howard to somebody like DeCamp was somebody that was a little bit too dark for him to fathom, and I think my closest connection with Howard is the fact that we got into boxing for the same reason. Because we got into it because we wanted to harden ourselves. I didn't have any great delusions I was going to be an athlete. He didn't. He wanted to experience it, and you can see that. And he ends up on an emotional level. He does a very good job of writing from a boxer's point of view emotionally, more so than L'Amour does. And L'Amour was a high level boxer. Because L'Amour has gotten to the point where he looks at boxing on a technical level, and he's now discussing it in a detached fashion, because his time boxing like Howard boxed was submerged behind the other stuff. I'm really trying with Howard. I regard Howard as the guy that basically saved my soul. So I consider it a job. I don't sell many of the books that I write about him, but I consider it a duty to try to review everything that he wrote at least once from at least one perspective, and to try to put it out there and try to encourage people to read it, especially young men who feel like there's not a place for them in the current today, because Howard writes about the outsider. He writes about the interloper. Even his alpha male characters are not insiders. They're all outsiders. After rereading his work, I'm really impressed with how he writes the feminine perspective. And you'll note a lot of the Conan stories, you read a lot of the material from another perspective, not from Conan's perspective. And often it's a female perspective, and these are sympathetic female characters. So, Howard's a real treasure trove, especially for young men now who are caught up in a world with all these like gender identity issues on top of everything else.
Another thing about Howard is he's a very multi-dimensional author, in my opinion. He has a great sense of humor. And that comes out in a lot of his works. I like the Breckinridge Elkins series, the Western series, and various other books that his sense of humor is really displayed. And there's a lot of texture to the work that, you know, most people think of the Conan stories and the, you know, that kind of thing, but there's a lot more to it.
And he'll embed some of that sense of humor in some of his other westerns, the more you know, the darker westerns, and also in some of his side stuff like Black Vulmea's Vengeance.
Yeah.
The Black Stranger, which was a Conan and a Black Vulmea story, he wrote it and failed to sell it in both versions. He'll put humor in that too and veil it a little bit more. So he had, if he would have lived longer and written longer, you probably would have seen him being looked back upon as somebody who explored the whole range of humor from action comedy, all the way down the spectrum. I really think that would have happened if he could have gotten himself through the darkest years. You would see an even more humor out of him as he got older.
As I think, and you would be able to speak to this probably more than I, that his early boxing stories influenced L'Amour's early boxing stories quite a bit.
Of course, I don't have any proof for it, but I would not be surprised at all. These guys are getting published in the same magazines. They both did well selling the boxing periodicals. They were both reading them. And there's a way that L'Amour almost takes his boxer out of the ring for his emotional experiences that you could read as, you know, for instance, as Robert and I are writing the same story, okay? And I read Robert's thing, and I see he went a certain way with the emotions of his character, and we're supposed to be writing the same story, then, well, you know, I would explore the character's emotions elsewhere. I wouldn't try to go to the same scene where Robert did it. And there, you could make a point that it looks like L'Amour was doing that with his boxing. With his boxing characters and his fiction, where they're being explored emotionally outside of the ring, where Howard's boxing guys, they're comedians outside of the ring, and inside of the ring, it's like a study in masculine emotion.
We're getting close to the end of the show. Before I wrap things up, James, do you want to add anything else about your work?
Just that I promise to try to finish as many of the fiction projects I have going on before the spring as possible. I think I'll be wrapping up like 6 novels this winter and this spring, novels and novellas. And I'm also wondering, Robert, what do you have on the horizon as far as your writing goes? Do you have anything in the works?
I just have my book, Journey to Vapor Island. I'm still working on promoting that.
Okay, well, I'll be looking forward to seeing that and seeing some more stuff if I will get a look at your book, okay, and let you know what I think. And if there's any of my stuff you'd like to see, just let me know and I'll send it to you. But I'd like to see what else you come up with, too.
And, Paul, okay? You've had a number of books out.
Well, I have two books. I have 2 books out. Can't even think of the name now.
No, please tell me.
Black House Rocked and Down Where the Devil Don't Go.
Black House Rocked and Down Where the Devil Don't Go.
And don't you have an upcoming book that hasn't been published yet?
I have a book Ann Sturzinger edited in the spring, and I frankly have to pay her for it before I send it to press. So it's gonna stay on the drawer till I pay her off for her editing.
Oh, good luck with that, man.
And then we'll it's called Strip Club Poetry. And Robert's been kind enough to donate one of his paintings for the covering, and it's not as erotic as it sounds, but.
That sounds very cool, man.
Actually comes from sitting in a strip club with my girlfriend writing poetry.
I'll be looking forward to reading that. Hey, Robert, don't beat your head against the wall too much trying to promote your book. Write some new stuff, too.
Yeah, it can get discouraging. Like, I had all these books planned, and I'm thinking, like, oh, the book's not selling. But I was thinking about a sequel, and I totally get that.
Well, just because it's the way publishing is changing, you know, it's just rough, and you know, you ought to just you ought to keep writing stuff.
And, Robert, I honestly think you could do a whole series based on that Journey to Vapor Island, and I have a lot of thoughts on it that will come out with my review. So.
Well, James LaFond, it's been an excellent show. I'd like to thank you so much for being on.
Well, thank you, Robert. Thanks so much for getting in contact with me.
And also, thanks, Paul Bingham.
Thank you, Robert. Thank you, Mr. James. It's really an honor to talk to you, sir.
Well, thank you, Paul, and I'm thrilled to meet you. This was a huge show for me here today.
Appreciate it.
We'll talk again.